This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. We start 2017 with some recordings sent in by members of the Airplane Geeks community. These look back at 2016 and ahead to 2017. In the news, we discuss angle of attack indicators for Skyhawks, the pilot shortage in Alaska, miscommunications between ATC and a commercial flight, A380 delivery issues, when is an F-35 an FA-18, comfort animals at the airport and in the air, and DHS collecting social media accounts. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 433 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and let's start right off by introducing the co-hosts. First, we have Rob Mark. He's senior editor at Flying Magazine. He's a flight instructor and publisher of the Jetwine blog. Hi, Rob.
Hey, well, listen, happy 2017 to everybody who made it back from 2016.
It's good to be here. It is good to be here. Also with us is our aviation historian, David Vanderhoof.
Happy New Year, everyone. Looking forward to an interesting 2017. And believe it or not, I actually got 3 flights in last year. So that's impressive. And we'll talk a little bit later. I'm going to give a good review of an airline, unlike my co-hosts.
Oh, very good. All right. Also with us co-hosting is the other Max, Max Trescott. He's a CFI, an author, and a glass cockpit expert. Max West, how are you?
Hey, hello, Max, and hello to the rest of the gang here. I had a really fun, relaxing, kind of happy holiday season, so I hope everybody else did as well. And if not, well, hey, there's the rest of 2017 to fix that.
Yeah, we can see what happens next time.
Exactly.
Also with us is Brian Coleman, our associate producer.
Happy New Year, everyone. And David, I don't know what you're talking about. I give good reviews of airlines when it's deserved. So, I I'm looking forward to giving some good reviews in 2017 as well. So as long as the airlines perform, they'll get their good review.
All right. That's a reference to an airline that regular listeners will understand. Well, this is our first episode of 2017. And coming up, we've got some recordings sent in by members of the Airplane Geeks community that look back at 2016 and ahead at 2017. We've got some aviation news, actually quite a lot of aviation news to talk about. Also, results from our recent listener survey and probably some other things along the way as well. But why don't we get started first off with the aviation news from the past, well, week or so. Are you guys ready?
Ready.
Yeah.
Ready from the West.
Our first story comes from AIN Online. This is Cessna adds safe flight AOA to new Skyhawks. Angle of attack system from Safe Flight Instrument Corporation is, well, it's going to be standard on new Cessna 172S Skyhawk deliveries that start this month in January. Textron Aviation is also offering the system as an option, a $5,000 option on the 182T Skylane in the Turbo Stationaire HDT206H. So we've talked about angle of attack indicators in, well, a variety of contexts, commercial aviation, general aviation as well. Rob, let's start with you. This seems like it's a pretty good thing for GA.
If I say anything contrary, I will get my head handed to me, I suppose. well, it of course, anything that reduces the number of accidents is a good thing. I think my only concern is feeling a bit I feel like we've done pilots a disservice a bit by somehow telling them that now they'll be able to know what their airplane's doing by looking at this little bunch of colored lights. I think, I don't know, I won't speak for Max T, but for me, I like to get people to look out the window and tell me what the airplane is doing. And I just think we've gotten too darn technology dependent. But also, I think what concerns me the most about this is that I don't quite see how this is going to help us in an area of stall spins, turns from base to final, where people wrap it around too tight, and it happens so quickly. I can't imagine how this is going to be of any help, and that's where I'd really want it. But I don't know. Max T, let me throw it at you. What do you think?
Oh, bah humbug.
I figured that. Okay, go ahead.
I take the other view. I think it's a really great thing. And I was surprised and delighted to see that they mounted the display right on top of the glare shield. You know, I expected, like everything else, it was going to be in the panel. They purposely put it up top of the glare shield so that, you know, when you're looking outside, it's in your field of vision. They want you to be looking outside, and this is going to be, you know, kind of like a mini heads-up display, right? It's not that prominent in front of you, but it's really in the right location. And I think anything that gives pilots extra relevant information at critical phases of flight is a good thing. And I guess they have tested this pretty extensively, say that it works extremely well in every regimen of flight they tested. So I'm kind of guessing that even in those turn to final stall type situations, this probably would give you some type of advance warning where you can go, oops, better stop doing that. And I think a lot of those situations occur when people overshoot the final and then try to fix it by honking on the rudder and, giving it tons of rudder, thinking that somehow is going to solve the problem. You know, if this beeps or, flashes a red light or something that just kind of tells them, hey, stop doing that, that could save a life, and I think it's worthwhile. Now, the thing that surprised me is these are going to be standard in all new 172 Skyhawks, but it's a $5,000 option in Skylanes and Stationairs, which to me says maybe they figure the people who are most likely to get in trouble are people training in 172s, and they want to make sure that all of those people had this kind of warning. People flying higher-end aircraft might be less likely to get in trouble, and they're going to make them pay for that extra piece of information. But it really was a very interesting product plan to include it for free in the small airplanes, but not the bigger ones.
Is this something that requires some additional training to operate, or
can you just,
yeah?
Well, I mean, if you don't train somebody, they're not going to know what to look for, and they won't know what to look for when. And of course, this is not just a visual system; it's also an oral system, and so you have to be able to, as Max said, kind of take the heads up display where you're kind of looking out the window, approaching the runway. And you have to be able to integrate the sounds that you're hearing with what the instrument is telling you. And that, I think, is almost I like that part more than the visual part, to tell you the truth. But that's just me.
Yeah, it makes a clicking sound as you get closer to it. They describe it as a Geiger counter. So the closer you get to stall, the more rapid the rate is. And so I think that's fantastic. You don't even have to be looking at this thing. Hopefully, if you start to hear it sound like a rattlesnake, you're in trouble.
Until you become like the Air Force in Vietnam, and as you cross the border, you start turning off things because it gets really annoying.
Yeah, this is something you really wouldn't want to have turned off.
I doubt you'll be able to turn it off, quite honestly, but maybe you can.
Are there other angle of attack indicators that they could have chosen besides this one, or is this kind of the market leader?
That's a good question. I do not have information to be able to answer that, quite honestly.
I think there are a couple manufacturers, and I think this is probably the more popular one. I think it's kind of interesting that if you were to look at which certificated aircraft out there have AOA indicators right now, not that many. I mean, the one airplane I remember flying that had one was the Flight Design CTLS, which is a light sport two-place aircraft. And, I can't remember a single other GA airplane I've flown that has one built in. So, hats off to Cessna. When Cessna does something, then it's, really considered mainstream.
All right. Well, let's move on. This is an item about the pilot shortage, but it's got a little bit of a different twist to it. This is about the pilot shortage in Alaska. And we have a New York Times article where they call Alaska, quote, the nation's most aviation-dependent state. They say that Alaska has six times as many pilots per capita as the rest of the nation. But for a variety of reasons, there are not enough pilots to service the local demand for bush pilots. Now, some of the reasons cited, pilots and mechanics are leaving Alaska because they can command higher salaries in the lower 48 states. Also, airlines are tending to train pilots internally, and so they're not looking as much as they used to the pool of pilots that are coming out of Alaska. And then also many international freight haulers, they've hired away number of Alaskan pilots. So, you know, we all hear about bush pilots and the skills that they have in that environment. And, of course, as the article points out, there are not that many roads in most of Alaska. And so it's really dependent on air travel and air freight to maintain the kinds of services and so forth that you need. So it's very interesting that we're seeing this problem in Alaska that's being exacerbated by all these factors.
And it's really, really, really cold outside.
So let's also not forget that the other part of the story was about how a drone or a series of drones, a system of drones, might be able to fill the gaps for delivering goods to these remote villages. And it's certainly a possibility.
Yeah, they note that the University of Alaska's Center for Unmanned Aircraft Systems Integration has been doing some testing. Who was it, Brian? You mentioned how cold it is in Alaska. Well, they've been testing unmanned aircraft in those kinds of Arctic conditions. The applications include things like oil companies using drones for pipeline inspection. And, you know, that's something that represents sort of an easy one in some ways for a drone, assuming that it can withstand the weather conditions, the environmental conditions, and could therefore replace manned aircraft performing that function. We have an item from the 1 Mile at a Time blog that's in the Boarding Area Network. This is called, Oi, you have to hear this audio between ATC and EVA Air pilots. Now, this is concerning that miscommunication between air traffic control and an EVA flight, EVA flight 777 that was leaving Los Angeles headed for Taipei. And this almost resulted in a crash into a mountain. This has been kind of widely reported in the news. Rob, you're probably pretty aware of what happened here. Maybe you can give us kind of a little bit of a rundown.
Well, I have to credit my co-host, Mr. Trescott, with pointing the audio out when he found it because he was just curious. Max T, I think you should be a detective, actually. But you know what was really scary is that I listened to it. At first, I thought, okay, it didn't sound like much. And you'll hear a part where the controller is cut out. I don't know if somebody had the mic keyed somewhere, but all you hear is climb to 7,000. You don't hear the aircraft ID. You don't hear a turn. Now, how the EVA guys got it, I don't know. It's always possible that they could have heard something that the ground receiver was not able to decipher, and hence that's why they did it. My guess is that FAA must have gone back and played the tape to listen to what the controller said, which is where they came up with that left turn concept. But it's not real clear from listening to the audio. And the audio runs, oh, I don't know, maybe it's 5 or 6 minutes of suspense. But what really is interesting is, there's no other way to say it, that the controller melted down. I mean, she took a situation that was problematic and she melted down and the pitch of her voice went up and she started talking faster and she made some mistakes and she just kind of whipped the whole thing into a frenzy. And it's kind of sad, but there's really nothing else you could say about that. And that, of course, I think is why they sort of reassigned this lady to something else, perhaps until she gets some retraining or something like that. But the one key is that whenever you have people on the frequency whose first language is not English, you don't get faster, you get slower, and you get much more distinct. Even if you sound like you're condescending, better to sound, you know, better to get yelled at as a controller for sounding like you were condescending when you say, you know, EVR 7109, turn right, right turn now, heading 180. And you know, you have to learn when it's time to emphasize certain words. And she just didn't do that. And so the pilots got confused. She got confused. And it was, you know, initially, again, it wasn't a big deal. But then it went on and on and on with this airplane heading north right towards the hill. And I went, oh, my God. And I guess they kind of just about did a pylon around the mountain there and just missed it. And boy, it was scary, though. It really was. I think any controller or any, you know, really competent pilot's going to hear that and go, holy smokes.
Hmm. I didn't get the sense that the pilots were kind of aware of the impending danger.
Oh, no, I don't think they were either. But that's also says something about their training. I mean, you know, you go into a place where it's flat. Maybe the only thing you have to worry about on departure is where are the high radio or TV towers. But when you're in a mountainous region, even if the hills are only 5,000 feet, nobody, I think, should be taking off into an area where there are hills and not have a general idea that we're headed east and the mountains are northeast from our departure point. So that if somebody turns you northeast, you go, oh, wait a minute. I don't think that's such a great idea. These guys seem to be clueless.
Hey, Rob, that's really one of the questions I had over this because, A, I heard the plane and listening to a 777 fly over your house at, you know, 2,000 feet is noisy and you're wondering what the heck's going on here. But and it is unusual for the aircraft to take off going to the east instead of over the west, which they normally do over the ocean to go. So the winds were different, so they turned the airport around for that. But for these guys not to know that they're at 5,000 feet and the mountain is at 5,700 feet and not to question the controller over that, that's what I really wonder about this whole thing, is why weren't the pilots more aware over this? Because don't you have departure maps and know where obstructions are and pay attention to your surroundings? What the heck was going on there?
Well, yeah, not to mention the fact that the airplane has ground prox, which should have been yelling at them quite a ways out, you know, with pull up, terrain. None of this makes any sense to me. But boy, that could have been really ugly.
Mm. Let's go back to the very beginning. I don't know if this aircraft came off of the sixes or the sevens, but they came off of either six right or seven right. And I think off of that runway, you should be getting a right turn because a left turn is going to head you toward, you know, either six left or seven left. And so I believe that the initial problem was this aircraft was turned in the wrong direction. And then I measured the distance. It looks like it's about, 20 miles from the airport to where you start to hit the mountains. And I don't know what their climb out speed is, but I don't know, 180, 200, something like that. You know, that puts those mountains about 6 minutes away. So you don't have a whole lot of time to fix that kind of problem. And the, I agree with you, Rob, that the controller's voice, you know, probably wasn't as helpful as talking too fast. But what I noticed is there were multiple times when she said, turn south. She didn't say turn right, you know, or turn left. You know, you're always supposed to do that. You know, the command starts with turn right to a heading of 180. You know, she was saying, turn southbound. And, you know, I don't think airline pilots are used to that.
I don't know. She just seemed like the pilots were making a mistake, and it never occurred to her that she was actually the one at fault.
Well, and I kind of agree with you, Brian. And at that point, you know, having watched controllers when I trained them and things like that, that's when, if there was a trainer there, you'd key in the mic and say, look, let me show you what you got to do here. And you've got to be very emphatic. And even if it you have to be literal and say, you know, EB error, I forgot what it was, 7103, you're headed the wrong way toward a mountain, turn right now. I mean, and you speak slow, but you sound like you mean it, because otherwise, you know, that didn't become a disaster only by, I don't know, luck. Because from what I saw, Max, on that thing you sent me, I mean, they didn't miss the Mount Wilson by much.
No, it was ridiculously close. I mean, it was chillingly close.
They flew right over my house. It was scary loud.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it just gives me the shivers thinking about it right now. I think we missed a major disaster in this country by not very much.
Yeah, but you know what I'm also wondering about now, and for people that aren't controllers, obviously, you wouldn't know it, but in the TRACON, when they have a ground prox warning in the airplane, I should say, the system yells at you. Like I said, it yells pull up, or terrain. But you'll get a low altitude alert in the radar room as well, and it yells so that not just the controller but that the supervisor will hear it. And how this all got to that point with that airplane turning around Mount Wilson with nobody jumping in there is just beyond me. I'd still love to see the NTSB report on that, because I'm sure there's going to be one.
Yeah, it sounds like there's a lot to investigate here, some lessons to be learned and some process changes maybe to be made. All right, let's take a look at Airbus and the A380 specifically. We have a couple of articles on that topic, one from Reuters. Airbus postpones deliveries of 12 A380 planes to Emirates Airline. In November, Emirates said they were having some technical issues with the Rolls-Royce engines powering their A380 jets. Now, it may not be related, but apparently Emirates, Rolls-Royce, and Airbus have together made a deal to postpone 6 deliveries from 2017 to 2018 and to postpone another 6 deliveries from 2018 to 2019. So this has a big impact on Airbus. We've talked about the production rate. They have a target to deliver. They did have a target to deliver around 20 A380s per year from 2018. That was announced earlier last year in 2016. But this will have an impact.
Yeah, and I think just like Boeing with the final production runs of the 747, I really believe this is the final death knell to the A380. And it's unfortunate, but it's one of those, it is what it is. Evolution happens. And having a large quantity of people going to point to point just isn't the way, or to the hub and spoke system. Passengers don't want to fly that way. They want to go from point A to point B, regardless of the origin or destination, and other aircraft serve that mission so much better.
Airbus also kind of took a hit on the A380s with Iran. USA Today talks about the deal. Iran just placed a firm order for 100 Airbus aircraft, which is, of course, great for Airbus. But there were 12 A380s contemplated in the preliminary agreement, but those were all dropped in the final firm order. So there's another 12 out of the schedule right there. So, yeah, I think Airbus is struggling a bit to maintain a break-even point. In some ways, like the 747, especially when it was first introduced and for many years after that, the sort of the flagship aircraft, not only for the manufacturer, but for the airlines that flew it or that do fly it, and for the countries where the national airline flies those kind of aircraft. The A380, I think, is seen in the same way. So I don't know, you know, Brian, it might have you know, a little more life to it because people will maybe try to, you know, kind of cling to the hope that maybe things will turn around. But yeah, at some point, Airbus maybe is going to have to make a hard decision.
Yeah, and I think that it's sad because it is a special aircraft that, again, fills a certain mission. I just don't think the traveling public wants to fly that mission any longer. You know, LA, London, London, wherever, Dubai, wherever. Yeah, it makes sense for that. But going LA to Melbourne, no, it absolutely doesn't make sense to do that. You know, going Chicago, Lagos, no, it doesn't make sense. So, you know, the A350 and the 787 are just going to take over that market.
Well, and of course, the deal with the Iranians hasn't even really been approved yet anyway. From the U.S. side, and you know, they may be Airbus airplanes, but they're quite a few of them are flying with electronics and engines and all that kind of thing that were built by the Americans. And so there's
is that Simba the Wonder Dog?
Simba?
So the U.S. has been barking at the Iranians to deal with that. So. I think that's yet to be seen.
Well, speaking of barking, we have an article in the Seattle Times. Trump asks Boeing for FA-18 pitch, citing, quote, tremendous cost overruns of Lockheed Martin F-35. Well, Donald Trump tweeted this, quote, based on the tremendous cost and cost overruns of the Lockheed Martin F-35, I've asked Boeing to price out a comparable F-18 Super Hornet. Well, we don't want to dive too deeply into politics because, you know the trouble we get in.
Yeah, but
no, there's no but. You can't replace.
No, David, they're different missions, right? They're different aircraft, different missions. Therefore, they're not the same. Therefore, you can't substitute one for the other. Can you?
The F-35C is designed to replace the Marine Corps and the Navy F-18 Super Hornets. He's comparing apples and oranges. Okay.
So the mission's the same, but it's apples and oranges.
That's correct.
Okay.
The words comparable aircraft cannot be achieved. Now, there'll be an article for Words Boring in the show notes where they talk about what it would take to take a Super Hornet to an F-35 weapons system. What you can get is an aircraft that maybe after some really advanced development by Boeing to get an 80% aircraft of what the F-35 is capable of doing. Yes, that's doable, but that's not a long-term solution. And Donald Trump is beginning to stick his nose in like we had before the holidays with the 730, the Air Force One debacle. He's looking dollar for dollar comparison, not necessarily what's involved with the aircraft or the mission package. It would be like what he's asking is, can a Boeing 787 or a be replaced by a Boeing 707 upgraded for all those airline people out there? Yes, you can sort of do that, but no, it's never going to happen. And he's playing a game so that Lockheed Martin will admit that they're over budget and Boeing is happy to act as the competitor for that. But it's an unrealistic expectation.
But not a bad bargaining strategy, right?
Yeah, that's kind of how I look at it. Is that if I'm in, you know, a defense contractor or, in the aerospace industry, providing services to the government. I mean, my takeaway is that, the new administration is likely to come after us and look for us to sharpen our pencils a little bit and see if we can manage costs to a greater extent. Now, in some cases that may be possible. In other cases, it may be possible only by de-scoping the capabilities of whatever the product or service is, which may or may not satisfy the, you know, the need as well as the administration.
It's a tweet. It's not a bargaining chip. We need to get used to the next 4 years of it being, he's going to say things and throw it up against the wall to see if it sticks. There, he has no real realistic expectation that the that Boeing is going to build F-18 Hornets instead of Lockheed Martin F-35s.
No, probably not. But he can still, you know, approach the manufacturers with threats, with, you know, statements like this, with tweets even, and you know, develop some kind of a reaction.
Which was successful. He had Lockheed Martin and Boeing chafing at the bit after this tweet.
And bottom line, I bet it saves, you know, more than $100 million off of, you know, $35 billion. No surprise, right? So, yeah, I agree. Unrealistic that an F-18 will ever do what an F-35 does. But in terms of, you know, pitting suppliers against each other to try and get the price down, yeah, okay. You know, that's certainly, you know, an okay thing to try to do.
You know, this is one of the things that we're going to talk about a little bit coming up, which is, you know, what's ahead possibly in 2017 for aviation. And one of the big items on my list is really just this, is what's the effect that the new administration is going to have on aviation. And I think right now, I mean, we just don't know.
And David, isn't the F-35 a fairly stealthy aircraft where the F-18 is not?
Boeing has worked hard. When we were dealing with the bidding for the Indian Indigenous Fighter program that was run by the French Rafale, Boeing had created a F-18I prototype, which added low observable technology to the F-18 Hornet. The F-18EF is substantially lower radar cross-section than the original Legacy Hornets. Sorry, Grant, but that's what they're called. And the Legacy Hornets, the Super Hornets, Boeing for the F-18I program came up with conformal fuel tanks that mount on top of the wings like the F-16 has, which reduces the necessary radar cross-section because it means you're not carrying bags underneath the wings, which the F-18 is still notorious for short range, so it has to carry external fuel tanks. The other part about it to add low visibility comp was they created a centerline pod which houses all of the weapons internally. So the air-to-air defenses as well as the ground ordnance would be mounted in this pod, so you would have very clean wings, a centerline pod that would blend into the fuselage, as well as overwing air-to-air overwing tanks for the additional fuel that all blended and reduced the radar cross-section. Does it mean that it's an F-35's radar cross-section? No, but it is a low observable cross-section. The biggest advantage the F-35 has that the F-18F E will never have is one giant sensor suite. There are sensor nodes all over the aircraft that are built into the wings, in the fuselage, etc., that give the pilot a 360-degree view with their helmet, as well as the ability to harvest all sorts of information from other aircraft and act as a battle node. The F-18F will never be able to do that, which is the technology that is really what costs so much. It's not necessarily the stealth as much as the fact that the F-35 will be able to take information and become a data manager for all sorts of aircraft, legacy as well as future aircraft.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah, it doesn't come cheap, right? It doesn't. That kind of stuff doesn't come cheap.
It doesn't.
Right. Well, one thing that does come kind of cheap is swine, pigs. And we have an article from the San Francisco Chronicle. SFO's,
I thought we weren't going to do any politics.
Yeah, I know that was coming. SFO's therapy pig keeps travelers from going hog wild, which, of course, is a great headline. Now, this pig, Lilu, wears a tutu, apparently, at least some of the time. She's now the designated therapy pig at San Francisco International Airport. She joins the WAG Brigade program at SFO that uses trained dogs in the terminals under escort. They're not running wild. We've talked about therapy dogs or therapy animals. We've talked about guide animals.
Therapy ducks. No, that was something different.
That was something different.
Service animals.
And kind of the problem that we've talked about is the tendency of a certain number of people, maybe even a lot of people, to claim their pet is a therapy animal and bring that into the airport, onto the plane, and so forth. So the interesting part about all this is that the U.S. Department of Transportation has got something called the Advisory Committee on Accessible Air Transportation. It's the ACCESS, A-C-C-E-S-S, Advisory Committee. And it was established, quote, to negotiate and develop a proposed rule concerning accommodations for air travelers with disabilities, addressing in-flight communications, accessible laboratories on new single-aisle aircraft, and, here we go, service animals. Now, the committee is interesting. We'll put a link in the show notes to the Department of Transportation's page on the committee. The membership includes representatives from industry, from accessibility and disability organizations. You see names like Boeing, the National Association of the Deaf, number of airlines, including United Airlines, JetBlue, several others, Paralyzed Veterans of America, IATA, National Disability Rights Network, and a whole lot more organizations. So these guys have been meeting, these people have been meeting to identify some proposals to deal with these things. Now, they have reached an agreement to improve the accessibility of lavatories to wheelchairs on single-aisle aircraft. They've also agreed to provisions for captioning of in-flight movies for those with hearing difficulties, and also audible transcriptions of those movies for the blind. But they have not been able to figure out or come to any agreement on service animals. And I'm guessing that it's just such a difficult issue to kind of get your arms around. And, you know, how do you manage this situation where people are bringing their pets along and saying, well, this is a service animal or a comfort animal or something like that?
I've got an idea. How about no?
No animals?
When pigs can fly.
You know, hey, I'm sorry. Service animals are dogs. I mean, they always have been. This whole thing about bring anything that breathes on and call it a service animal is something in the last decade, and it's going to get away from the airlines if they don't do something about it. I saw a story a few months ago about somebody that had one of those small horses, not a pony, but a...
Yeah, it was a miniature horse.
A miniature horse.
A pygmy horse or something, yeah.
I mean, so here's the big question. We're all whacked out about the fact that we don't want people on the airplane talking on their cell phone, right? Because we don't want to be the one to sit next to some gabby guy or girl. But what happens when somebody brings a pig on and the pig is in your aisle and the pig decides to poop? What happens then? I mean, what do they do with that? I don't know.
The flight attendant comes.
Why should we even have to deal with that? I'm sorry. If you're so screwed up that you need a pig for comfort on an airplane, you probably shouldn't be on the airplane. I'm sorry. You just shouldn't.
And Rob's address for those who'd like to respond.
I mean, I just think this is crazy.
It's tough. The problem, I think, is that the difficulty is that I think that there are some individuals that, you know, need this kind of emotional support for a number of different kinds of reasons. But when all these other people start abusing this they cause these problems for everybody. And when it comes to getting a group of, you know, reasonably intelligent people together in a room representing a number of different interests and perspectives, and to come up with a solution to this problem is really difficult. So I think the Department of Transportation has announced that because this committee could not come to grips with this issue of service animals and so forth, that the DOT, they intend to draft their own rules to cover service animals. And we'll just have to see what they come up with.
Well, let's see if it gets past the new DOT secretary.
Well, that's true as well.
No, Max, I completely agree with you in that I think there are a certain amount of people that actually need, and it's legitimate, to have their service animal with them, regardless of what that animal is. The fact that another group of people choose to abuse the policy and piggyback on top of these people, it's screwing it up for those that actually need it. And that's really unfortunate. And writing policy becomes very difficult when common sense needs to come into play. And how do you reconcile these? That's what these people have to deal with, is just how to deal with this. And I feel bad for them because it's really a tough problem.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, there's no easy solution to this really, really complex thing. Because again, there are people that truly need these animals that need to get from point A to point B, and air travel is their only way to get there. But everyone else is just screwing it up for them, and that's what I really feel bad about.
Well, I don't know. I think that's an open and to be clear, I meant what you were just saying, that, you know, the airlines need to say no to the people that are just making a joke out of this. I mean, people have been flying with guide dogs for years, and it never has been a problem. But when you get people that take advantage of it, I don't see how regulating it is going to make a big difference. I can't believe the airlines just can't say, no, you know, I'm sorry. The big pig just kind of doesn't fit with, you know, all the other people that have paid airfares as well and deserve a comfortable flight. I just don't think one person has the right to impose that on everybody on the airplane.
Well, there's another imposition that's occurring, and this will be our last news story. This is from Condé Nast Traveler. U.S. border security now asking foreign travelers for social media accounts. Wait, when I saw that, what is this about? Well, foreign travelers who are entering the U.S., I think primarily on a visa waiver program, they're being asked by the Department of Homeland Security, the DHS, to, quote, voluntarily provide their social media accounts. Now, they're being asked for this information because this is seen as a method to help identify potential threats and prevent terrorism.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought my mic was off. I'm sorry.
Well, you know, when I crossed the border from YY leaving Toronto, Pearson, they asked me my social media accounts. I said jetwine.com.
Well, good done, David.
David. You know, I mean, come on. Seriously, though, I think David's right. I mean, who that is a bad guy is going to say, oh, yes, well, actually, my Twitter account is so-and-so, and my Facebook is this and that, and you can read all about my adventures in other parts of the world. I mean, come on.
Actually, Rob, I look at it from the other direction, where I find it offensive. One of the things that I truly believe about America...
They're asking you?
Yeah.
So do I. I'm sorry. That's what I meant.
But it's just... This to me is absurd, because one of the things I think that makes America great today is the freedom of speech. And although I might not agree with you, the ability that you have to say whatever it is that you say, I think is phenomenal. And many people have died for us to have this ability to say whatever it is that we say, regardless of how much I disagree with it. And to give up voluntarily... your social media accounts, I find that offensive.
And but they're not asking Americans to do it.
I don't care. It doesn't matter to me.
Brian.
It truly doesn't matter.
What? Brian, one of the things I used to do when I used to lecture at Michelle's classes on internet security and blogging, etc., was I would bring up my map of IP addresses for my blog, which just flew by. And on that map was the Pentagon, the FBI, the CIA, Moscow.
And they don't have a proxy server to fool it, to get around that?
No, they don't need it. And like I said to my students was, I said, if you read my blog, the words airplane, bombs, nuclear, terrorism, all of those buzzwords appear on a regular basis. I don't have any problem with the guys that sit in the CIA who I know read my blog or the FBI or the NTSB and look at my blog and say, okay, he's not a threat, even though all of his accounts show up with buzzwords that are a threat. You need to learn to accept that, you know what, if you're not doing anything wrong, you're not going to get harassed. Yes, I would rather them be monitoring me and me be smart enough to know that what IP addresses are showing up on my blog to know that, yes, if I say something really dramatic, I might get a phone call. But I've done nothing wrong. It's not an offensive thing to me that those organizations are looking at all of our blogs, because Rob is the same way. This podcast is the same way. If you looked at any of the buzzwords that come across it, likewise, Max's website, 30,000 feet, the things we talk about are buzzwords, and they're buzzwords that are going to get monitored and have a second look. And after that second look, they go, oh, it's just David. Never mind. That doesn't bother me. But my students were dumbfounded. But why? I said, because what you write on the internet is forever. Anything you write will be there forever, no matter how important you think you can delete it, chase it, or whatever. There will be a way to find it later. So if you are writing stuff or paying attention to stuff or looking on your Facebook account with stuff, it doesn't matter. There's going to be somebody who's going to see it, and it's going to be there forever. So when you're and as I told my, used to tell my college students, that post of you drinking heavily, looking like a drunk slob, hitting on some guy or gal is going to be there forever. Your mom and dad might not ever see it, but somebody else has. And somewhere along the lines, it's probably going to come back and bite you in the ass.
Hmm. I guess if this a policy of making this request for social media accounts produces some value, Well, let me turn it around. If it doesn't produce any value, then I think they should drop it, because I think a lot of visitors from other countries are going to be insulted by this, or you know, just find this an untenable invasion of their privacy. We know that privacy definitions are different in different countries of the world, and let's not, you know, tick off people who might like to come and visit the United States if this thing has no value. And, you know, I don't know if it does or not. I have no basis to.
And who's going to decide?
Yeah.
Who's going to decide whether it has any value?
I don't know. And that's exactly my point, in that the TSA has said, well, there hasn't been a terrorist attack on an aircraft since we imposed all this crap from 9/11. And all they have done is suck time out of my life because of this. I'm trying to think of a polite word to say, but this inconvenience that they've imposed upon me that has resulted in me not feeling any safer. MIM, yes or no? I don't know. I don't feel safer. Therefore, I still am very strongly opinionated over how they have not effectively made me safer. But yet they say, oh, because of all this, you're safer. And I say bullcrap to that. I don't agree with it.
All right.
So asking people for their Twitter account, if and especially if it's voluntary, if you're dumb enough to give it.
If someone's dumb enough to give it, Brian, if somebody walked up to me and said, to enter this country, you need to know, give me what your Twitter account is. Okay, it's DM Vanderhoof. I have nothing to lose by giving them my Twitter account.
Yeah, but then it's not voluntary, is it?
I could say no.
Well, I know, and that was going to be my question.
I mean, it's voluntary.
What happens to you if you say no?
Right, and then you enter the country anyway, who cares?
It's like you don't want to go through. My dumb experience going to Canada was I went through the full body scanner. And believe it or not, I had left a plastic comb in my pocket, a small travel plastic comb, after emptying out everything else. Would you believe they pulled me aside for secondary screening because that showed up? I was perfectly happy with that he pat me down and I realized that in my pocket I had a comb. Because that means that scanner sensed it enough to pick up something like a plastic explosive. You know, it didn't bother me. And I, ironically, the TSA agent set it aside as the cameras showed him to. He pulled it out of my pocket and confiscated it. Then he proceeded to grab it from the table and palm it and hand it back to me as I left the security screening. If you're going to choose not to give it, then you should be able to. I mean, if it's going to be optional, there should be another way. You just document that they refuse to give it, you know, and then when something comes up, well, this person refused to give us the information. You can always document it that way. Or you could, like, if you don't want to go through the full body scanners, you can always go through and get the pat down in the grope. I mean, it's there's always an alternative. Is there not?
Well, it depends on where you are. I guess, you know, Brian, you and I you do more international than I have. But I mean, I've done two or three trips in the last 6 months, and I'm trying to imagine trying to imagine landing in Paris or in Ireland or in Berlin, and them saying, before you come in, we want your social media account number, addresses and whatever. And me going, no, what do you need that for? And them saying, well,
you
can always say no, but you've got to deal with the consequences, which at a security checkpoint are probably not too pleasant. Well, why don't we draw this to a close just simply with this, that I think we've sort of teed up a couple of issues in this rather lengthy news segment that you all listening might have some thoughts about. And we'd love to hear your ideas. We love hearing from our audience, and we really encourage it. So, if you have some thoughts on some of these topics, please write to us, thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And we'd love to hear your feedback. Now, speaking of hearing from our listeners, you'll recall that, maybe about a month ago, we asked you to think about sending us some recordings, either looking back at 2016 or looking ahead to 2017. And we did hear from a number of you, and we really appreciate that. So we'd like to listen in on some of the thoughts of other listeners. Let's start with Bill Berry. Bill is the chief historian for NASA, and he was actually thinking of putting together a summary for us. But NASA TV put together something, a little video. It's about 3.5 minutes. It's not too long. So we'll have this in the show notes, but it's called What Happened This Year at NASA. And they talk about the International Space Station. They talk about Mars, other things going on in the solar system and so forth. So look for that in the show notes, kind of a summary of some of the highlights from NASA in 2016. Thanks, Bill, for sending that along. We did get a recording from Ariel. Now, he's a really active guy in our Slack listener team. And he sent us a little recording. Let's listen to Ariel.
Hello, everyone. This is Ariel from Israel, and I want to talk to you about two things that happened in 2016 in the aviation world. First thing, at November, we had big amounts of fires that required the firefighting squadron to be pushed to its limits. In addition, it required the help of countries from all over the world, like Russia, Croatia, Cyprus, Greek, Italy, and many more, that sent their help in personnel and planes. Second thing was in December, that was the landing of the two F-35s A or Adir to Israel. This is a really remarkable event that was waited for in the military and air force for a long time. Now let's continue about what I want to see in 2017. First thing is the arrival of the next F-35s to Israel. Also, I would be happy to continue and send and deliver news from Israel to you. Thanks for listening. This is Ariel, your geek from Israel.
All right, thanks, Ariel.
Yay!
Yeah. David, do you know how many F-35s Israel is supposed to get?
The initial order is 20, and I think there's another 20 on order.
Wow.
But Ariel can correct me. Ariel's fun. He's probably learned more and taught us more than anybody else in the Slack team. He's
a high school student.
He's a high school student. And just he's awesome. I love looking at his posts, and he engages everybody, and he's not afraid to ask questions. And when we put up an English word he doesn't know, he asks, and everybody's polite and responds. It's really cool. So we love having him as one of our leads on our Slack team.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Next up, Micah sent us a little piece, some of his reflections from 2016. So here's Micah, our main man.
So thinking back on 2016, the first thing I guess I need to say is I'm probably going to offend someone. Yeah, a strange way to start a year-end reflection, but it needs to be said. Why, you ask? Well, as we mature, remembering names and faces is not as easy as, oh, geez, okay, who am I kidding? I've never been good with names and faces. So let me start off reflections on 2016 by saying that it's likely I'm going to miss some important event and or leave someone out. In fact, I have no doubt it's going to happen. But please, if it's you I leave out, don't be offended, because, as George Costanza once said on Seinfeld, and I quote, it's not you, it's me. What does that mean, and why am I talking about people when it comes to year-end reflections on a podcast about aircraft? Well, because, as usual, airplane geeks historian David Vanderhoof was correct, and I learned from him. David once said, when talking about Oshkosh, that the first time you go to it, it's for the airplanes. But when you go back, it's for the people. Well, it's not just Oshkosh, friends and listeners. It's everything. 2016 was about people for me. It started in February, when Airplane Geek's associate producer Brian Coleman called me and said, hey, Micah, you want to go to Farnborough with me in July? And it ended with the Plane Talking Safety Towel Crazy Airline Pilot Geek's Christmas Extravaganza Live podcast, and then, a few days later, a meetup with Pilot Pip of the Plane Safety Podcast in Bangor, Maine. At the time, Pip was ferrying a Hawker 750 from London, England to Wichita, Kansas, so we had a chance to hook up. In between, the year was filled with an amazing array of different events and people. I mean, there were new friends, old friends, and even new old friends, if you can grasp that concept. There was a big Airplane Geeks podcast and meetup at the Yud Verhazy Center, and being able to spend time and reconnect with Max, David, Brian, and Aunt Benet. I met Ken Krantz and his family there, got to have dinner sitting next to NASA historian Bill Barry, and had my picture taken with Cherokee Sioux. Also, I sent a hug to Jennifer Adams in Oshkosh through Hillel Glazer. The Monday after the Yud Verhazy Center event, I got to meet Captain Nick Anderson from the Airline Pilot Guy podcast and take him out for Kosher Deli for his first time. And by the way, you know what one of the best parts of the Yud Verhazy Center weekend was for me? Well, when I said goodbye to both Brian and Captain Nick, it wasn't goodbye. It was, see you in 3 weeks, as Farnborough was coming right up. And Farnborough? What can I say? From unexpectedly meeting with Fred Sampson when he spotted me among the throng in Heathrow, to being chauffeured through the UK by audio genius Neville Bounds, meeting Captain Al Evans from Flight Fear Solutions, Carlos Stebbins and Matt Smith from Plane Talking UK, Marcus Volter from Omega Tau, reconnecting with Captain Jeff Nielsen, Dr. Steph Plummer, Captain Nick, and hanging out with Brian, The whole experience was just overwhelming. And that doesn't include all the amazing listeners. Well, not just listeners, really. Community members that I met. That's where I'd better stop. I'll never be able to get through that list. I just wish that circumstances wouldn't have prevented Airplane Geek regular and Aviation Extended host Peter Johnson from being there. By the way, did you notice I haven't even mentioned how incredible the actual air show was in Farnborough? I mean, it was amazing, but not as amazing as the people. But the year didn't end there. Right here in Portland, Maine, I got to meet up with listener Jeff Lovejoy and his father, and have been in touch with Ernie Eaton, who flies helicopters out of Sanford. Later in the year, I connected with Captain Rick Bell, who's organizing the Wings Over Pittsburgh show coming up this May. I hosted Captain Jeff and recorded Airline Pilot Guy episode 246 from my kitchen. And after all these years, finally had a chance to speak directly, well, over Skype anyway, with Steve Vischer and Grant McCarran, former Airplane Geek regulars and current hosts of Plane Crazy Down Under. They were part of the Plane Talking Safety Tow Crazy Airline Pilot Guy Spectacular Christmas Extravaganza Live, too. With all that going on this year, I managed to write and record 22 new pieces for air on 4 different podcasts on 2 continents, not to mention re-record 6 older stories for first-time airings on new shows. On top of that, I was able to do my first ever live piece that was written as it was being told. Yeah, I've got to say, I'm proud of myself. If only my mother and father, Harriet and Lou, were around to see and hear how they both influenced and inspired me. Grandpa Max, too, for that matter. So, my friends, I need to thank you for a great year. In many ways, one of my best years ever, to be honest. In particular, I need to thank you, the Airplane Geeks most of all. If it weren't for me discovering you, back in February 2010, episode 83, Aviation Jet Party, this never would have happened. Thanks to all the other podcasts that I found through you. And thanks to all you listeners, community members, and new friends, even those of you I haven't met yet. Let's all look forward to a terrific 2017, and hopefully meeting up sometime. Happy New Year. For the Airplane Geeks here in Portland, Maine, this is your main man, Micah.
Nicely done, Micah. Boy, that I don't think I realized how much that guy got around last year.
He did. Yes, absolutely. And, you know, if you're a new listener to this show, and you're listening to Micah wondering, you know, how all those things could happen to to one airplane geek, that could be you. It's not that difficult. Many, many other listeners, members of our community have similar experiences with meeting exciting new people and doing all these things. It's kind of a big part of, you know, what being an av geek is all about. Now, Brian, Micah talked about the Plane Talking Safety Tow Crazy Airline Pilot Geek Spectacular Christmas Extravaganza Live.
Yep.
So I'll ask you just a second to maybe give us some of your thoughts on that. But if that long title really throws you listening for a loop, that's sort of an amalgamation of a whole lot of different aviation-related podcasts. And Brian, you and Micah were part of this extravaganza.
Yeah, I can't actually say that it happened during work hours, but it happened during work hours, and I took, you know, 2-ish hours off of work to participate in that, and it was so much fun. And all these guys, I mean, all these other aviation podcasts, some people might think we are competitive, and I truly think that we're not. We are so complimentary to each other. And having everyone in one session and just sharing our love towards aviation was so much fun. And being around everyone again, you know, some of them I've met in person, others only on the phone or through Skype or through instant messaging or whatever. It was just great to be able to share yet another experience with these people. And I'm assuming that the show's been released on YouTube, and I highly encourage everyone, if they haven't looked at the Farnborough show on YouTube, to go ahead and try and find the the extravaganza on YouTube. It was just a blast, and I think I think our listeners would really get a kick out of listening and or seeing it.
The audio version is out. I listened to that just recently, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes. I looked to see there is a they did do a video as well. Brian, is that right?
Yeah, we were doing a live YouTube stream, and they said that they were going to publish it on YouTube. I don't know if it actually happened yet, or if it's still in the process of editing, or, you know, who knows, maybe the file was too large. I have no idea. But yeah, we were doing a live YouTube stream at the time, and it was fun. Everyone was in holiday garb, including myself, and I apparently some people noticed and or appreciated my Santa Claus hat. So it was a tremendous amount of fun.
All right, let's move on. We received an email from Bill English. He's a lead investigator for the NTSB. And he gave us some thoughts about the NTSB's drone program in 2016. It very interesting. You might wonder why the NTSB is involved in drones. And I guess, David, there's really kind of two reasons. One is because they want to be prepared for the situation that hopefully won't happen, but maybe eventually will, where they need to investigate an accident where there's a drone involved. And the second reason is that they see also drones as being a tool that they can use for accident investigations. Do you sort of see it that way, David, as sort of the two main reasons for the NTSB to be involved with drones?
Yeah, and we're fortunate enough because Max and I have had Bill on both on this show and on UAV Digest, and he's developed a drone program, and they want to use drones to survey a crash site to get a, and they're working on both ends of the spectrum. It's really kind of interesting that, you know, the guy that is writing the book on what to do when something happens is also the one writing the book on how to use it as a tool when something happens. So it was a really interesting thing, and they've gone through, the NTSB is not connected to the FAA, so that Bill has had to go through and get all of his certifications, and we've been sort of following that on back channels as he went through the process of getting his certifications from the FAA so that he can start writing the procedures for the NTSB. So I know that's a lot of letters, folks, but it is kind of it's been an interesting process for us on spectators, and I know Bill as the participant.
Yeah, they started last year, 2016, operating under the Section 333 exemption that was the only method at that time for conducting operations of certain types with drones. Then I think, as many of you know, Part 107 came out during the year. And so now the NTSB is kind of lined up with the requirements of Part 107. They've obtained their public agency COA. They've developed a program plan, a flight operations manual, SOPs, checklists, all the usual kinds of stuff. So, yeah, like you say, David, I mean, they're doing themselves what everybody has to do to operate drones, either commercially or as a public agency, and so forth. Now, he noted that they've worked with other federal agencies during the year in order to sort of fine-tune their manuals and procedures. And they say that they're working with some other partners in looking at outsourcing in certain areas. And they're also going to keep developing those procedures as they deploy drones themselves in more and more complex investigations. He notes that the budget for all this is really small, that the team involved in all this is small, but there's a recognition, I think, that it's important for the NTSB to be doing that. He also noted that an informal group has been formed of accident investigators from over a dozen countries who are using drones in their work. So I think that's really fascinating. And I'm sort of happy to see that our NTSB is, you know, working with and sharing information with other investigators when it comes to drones. And he does note that the NTSB actually has deployed drones on some aviation and rail accidents, and they've used them to create things like wreckage diagrams and maps and 3D models of the area and so forth as part of their investigation. So I want to thank Bill English for a great update on what the NTSB has been doing in the past year with drones. Okay, up next, we have Errol Cavett. This is something that he put together for us, a couple of minutes talking about some 2016 highlights. So let's listen to Errol.
G'day geeks, Errol Cavett calling from Auckland, New Zealand. My 2016 highlights, quite a few. Firstly, I got to attend four of the flying weekends at the Vintage Aviator. This is Peter Jackson's collection of World War I aircraft designs, a mixture of replicas, very authentic reproductions, many with original engines, and originals. On the last weekend of each summer month, pilots and crew are gathered to keep everyone current and to practice displays. Highlights this year were flights by a Sopwith Snipe reproduction, a FE-2B Night Bomber reproduction, and a DH-4 replica, along with close-up viewing of a BE-12 and LVG-C6 reproduction. I finally took a flight in the New Zealand Catalina Preservation Society's Kanzo ZK-PBY. This aircraft has been undergoing heavy maintenance for the last few years and returned to flight at Easter. At the New Zealand Warbirds Open Day in November, I went on a scenic flight over the Waitemata Harbour and downtown Auckland. In September, I was able to join two RNZAF veterans from the 1960s on a special trip. They were taken inside the Museum of Transport and Technology's Short Sunderland four-engine flying boat, which is under restoration. They shared many stories and memories during the visit, and these are available on a Wings Over New Zealand podcast. From August to October, I spent a lot of time chasing de Havilland Mosquito TV-959. This wooden wonder was completely rebuilt outside Auckland by Avspecs, using a new fuselage and wings manufactured by Glyn Powell. After watching engine runs take place, I finally managed to see the takeoff and landing of the fourth and final test flight in October. The Mozzie is now being reassembled at Paul Allen's Flying Heritage Collection in Washington State. I had thought that the Mozzie was my top highlight of 2016. But then I remembered my trip to Australia in April for the Wings Over Illawarra show. In terms of aircraft scene, it was a little disappointing. Three of the five aircraft that I was particularly interested in didn't fly for various reasons. So why was it extra special? People. I had a great time because of the people I caught up with and was introduced to. From volunteers at museums in the show, to the plane crazy down under blokes and the rest of the commentary team, to sharing beers with the Russian roulette's team in the motel car park. A brilliant time. Good luck, AvGeeks, and thank you.
Thanks, Errol. Now, Errol is a pretty decent photographer, as it turns out, and captured some great shots of some of these old, beautiful aircraft. I don't know if you guys had a chance to take a look at any of those. We'll have those, or a link to those in the show notes, as well as a link to a video that talks about some Sunderland veterans who got together, their former number 5 squadron veterans from the Royal New Zealand Air Force. And it's a very interesting video, historic video.
And Max, if I could throw in here, I just found out today that I'm actually going to be in New Zealand in November. So for Errol or anyone else that might want to get together, just want to throw that out.
Wow.
Send me an email at brian@airplanegeeks.com and would love to arrange a meetup in New Zealand.
Cool. Very cool. All right. Now we have Glenn sent us a short recording looking at some of his predictions for 2017. So here's Glenn.
Hello, geeks. It's Glenn here from New Zealand. Happy New Year to you all. And a few of my predictions for year 2017. I really don't think we're going to see any more new orders for 747s. I think the UPS thing was a real one-off, and I think they practically gave them away, I think, Boeing, just so they could keep the production line going for the Air Force One. I do believe Trump will actually order those three 747s. I think it's probably inevitable. It has to be. The 747 has to be replaced by something. The A380, I don't think they'll be selling any new orders of those either. I think the 787 will just keep rolling along. I can't see them making a profit on that aircraft. The 777, well, I think that's, yeah, they're not thinking of selling more of those anyway until at least the 777-10 comes in, sorry. The 757, I do believe Boeing will actually announce they're actually going to build a replacement for it. I don't think they can let Airbus get away with making the A321ER, I think they're calling it. I think Airbus will actually outsell Boeing again in 2017. I do believe the F-35 will have more problems. They'll probably get grounded again with some other issue. Engine, avionics, who knows, software, something. The Scorpion jet, Textron, in its attempt to sell light. I can't see anyone actually buying that jet. I mean, it's such a good idea, but I don't think so. I think that Lockheed will win the TX competition for the next replacement for the T-38 Talon. Way overdue, of course. Apart from that, I kind of can't think of anything else, really, off the top of my head. As I say, Happy New Year to you all, as I said before. Glenn out.
All right, thanks, Glenn, for that.
What did he say, flame out?
Not flame out.
Glenn out.
Glenn out.
Glenn
out. He said Glenn out.
It just sounded odd. I don't know.
Yeah, but another Kiwi for me to get together with in Auckland. So I'm looking forward to this. There are two now on the list.
There we go. All right. We'll just mention one other. We'll put a link to this in the show notes. John Walton put together an interesting little PaxX Minute over at the Runway Girl Network. A short video, what's in store for PaxX in 2017. So if you're a real fan of seat pitch and in-flight entertainment and the passenger experience, look for that over at the show notes on the website at airplanegeeks.com/433. All right, we want to spend just a few minutes giving you some information about the results from our 2016 listener survey. We put that out, a couple of months ago. We got a lot of responses, some great feedback. About 366 people responded to the survey, which is just excellent. And again, we got some good information. Some of it that is maybe easier to describe is sort of the demographics, which is kind of interesting. We asked what's the overall rating that you gave Airplane Geeks on a 7-point scale. Almost all 5s, 6s, and 7s, mostly 6s. So it was pretty much at the high end of the scale, which I guess we were kind of hoping.
Yay, us.
Getting down to who are the listeners, we asked, what's your personal role in aviation? And we found that the bulk of them, 65% of the respondents, said that they were an aviation enthusiast. Fully 25% are employed in the aviation industry. 7% are just an observer of the aviation scene. And 3%, me and a couple other guys, I guess, retired from aviation. So most people consider themselves aviation enthusiasts, but a quarter of you are actually employed in the aviation industry in some fashion or another. One of the interesting questions that we asked are, how many of you are pilots? The results were, a little bit surprising. Very high percentage of pilots, at least higher than I thought we were going to experience. 10% are commercial pilots. 35% identify themselves as GA pilots. 2% military or government agency pilots. So that's 47% of the total are pilots. 21% want to be pilots, and 32% are not pilots and don't have any plans to be. So very heavily weighted towards listeners who are pilots. Rob, was that a surprise to you, Rob, or did you kind of expect that to be the case?
I guess maybe I thought it was actually going to be a little more, to be honest. But, again, I think that the listeners never fail to surprise us with the questions they ask or, you know, why they are so giving of their time as to spend almost 2 hours with us every week. Holy smokes.
The age breakout is kind of interesting. The younger crowd, less than 20 years old, is pretty small, 2%. The 20 to 29-year age bracket is 8% of the respondents. And then we get up to some big numbers. The 30 to 39-year age bracket, 28% of the listeners. 40 to 49, 26% of the listeners. 50 to 59, 23%. So, Rob, there's a bunch of old guys out there. Is 60 and over, 13%. So it's spread across all age groups, maybe a little underrepresented in the very young listener category. But, yeah, you'd kind of expect that.
Yeah, but there's no bucket called Rob and older. Yeah. So I was kind of expecting that.
Yeah, that's real funny, Brian.
Okay. I'm so close to you.
did you just make that one up yourself, or
actually I did.
Max Prescott, does this kind of track with the age brackets of the students that you instruct?
You know, I was just taking a look to see how it compares with both podcast listeners in general and with pilots. So we skew older than the normal podcast listener. I mean, if I look at the 50% point there, it's probably about 45. And if I look at the age of pilots in general, I think the average age is about 50. So it looks like we skew slightly younger than the pilot population as a whole, which makes sense to me because older pilots are going to go, what's a podcast?
Yeah, hopefully for not too much longer. Maybe we should all, you know, find an old aviator and tell them about podcasts. The next one is, this was depressing. I was really depressed at this. So we asked for the gender of the respondents. And as you might think, there are two categories. Female portion of our listeners, 2.8%.
Well, but we're trying really hard, aren't we? I mean, we really, really try.
I kind of would like to think that we only had 2% answer. Not necessarily that our women need to answer these surveys more than there's a bigger population out there that don't want to be noticed.
Yeah, you know, this is the internet and, you know, people are always posing. So I think we have a lot of male pilots posing here on this survey. You know, they're really, you know, teenage, I don't know.
Right. Yeah. We're told that the percentage of pilots who are women is 4%, maybe 5% if you include those who are also student pilots. So I was hoping to at least kind of reach that point, but we didn't. And I don't know why. I don't know if it's because what we say and do is not of interest to women or something else. I'm not sure.
Yeah, so you dames out there, man, we want to hear from more of you.
Yeah, okay, that just takes care of that population.
Yep, just went down to 1%. Thanks.
Yeah, I mean, they just don't get it, I don't think.
I just really hope that as we continue to show what fantastic opportunities there are for women and male pilots expose this podcast to their daughters and
oh, great.
Spouses.
You want male pilots to expose themselves to their daughters.
He did not say that.
I want them to expose the podcast to their daughters. I truly hope that we can continue to increase the female population in... That didn't sound right either.
Yeah, but we know what you mean, yes.
You
want to grow the listenership amongst women.
We try really hard. And there are a bunch of really great things that women do in aviation. And we want to give them exposure to the rest of the world over these great, fantastic things that they do and the contribution that they make to the industry. And this shouldn't be a male-dominated industry because women have an equal part in it. And whatever I view my job, whatever we can do to give them the opportunity to present their story, I am 100% in favor of that, and that's what my goal for 2017 is to do, is to show just what a fantastic career this is, what a great industry this is, and how it doesn't have to be so male-dominated, and how women have played in the past a huge part of it, and how they will continue to be, and for us to be beacon's not the right word either, but how we can focus on what they do and really show their accomplishments. And I'm really proud of the fact of what we've done, and I look forward to being able to do that in the future.
Yeah, we're going to keep trying. We asked people how long they'd been listening to the Airplane Geeks, and this is another one that surprised me. Almost 44% of the respondents have been listening for more than 3 years, so lots and lots of long-time listeners. Listening for about 3 years was about 16%, 22%, 2 years, 10%, 1 year, and around 8%, less than 1 year. So most of you listening have been listening for a long time, and we really, really appreciate that. If everybody had been listening for less than a year, that would send us a different message altogether.
Or would they have dropped off and not responded to the survey at all?
That's right. Yeah, maybe that's true. Yeah. Another one on show length, because this is a conversation, a debate that takes place fairly frequently.
Weekly.
Yeah, weekly. So we asked, is the show too long, just right, or too short? Well, just right won out on this one. 77% of the people think that the show length currently is just right. 7% think it's too short. And about 15.5%, 16% say that it's too long. So we seem to be pretty much hitting the mark on that one in terms of length. Another kind of interesting statistic, how many other podcasts do you listen to on a regular basis? Well, 3% say that they don't listen to any other podcasts, which is kind of surprising. But
all those smart people.
All the smart people. 38%.
That would be the 3% of women we have, right?
Yeah, maybe. 38% listen to between 1 and 5 other podcasts. 31% listen to between 6 and 10 podcasts. 13%, 11 to 15 other podcasts. 6%. 16 to 20%, and the rest is more. I tell you, from looking at this kind of statistic for podcasts in general, our aviation listeners listen to many more podcasts on average than most other podcast listeners.
And Max, quite honestly, if we didn't spin off so many podcasts, we would not have nearly the competition that what we have today.
The more podcasts, the better. All right. So in terms of geography, amongst the respondents, 30 countries and even 30 countries were represented. When you look at our downloads, it's a lot bigger than that, several multiples of that. But amongst the respondents, 30 countries were represented, the United States being the largest at 57.7%, 58%, call it, of our listeners who responded to the survey from the U.S., 10% from the U.K., followed by 7% from Australia, about the same for Canada. And then we dropped down percentage on a percentage basis quite a lot, 3% for Germany, a little over 2% for New Zealand, followed by the Netherlands, Sweden, Ireland, and France. And after that, it really tails off to less than 1%.
What I find really interesting about this one is the percent of people per capita, you know, places like Australia, the Netherlands, Sweden, there's a significant number of people that listen to our show from those places. And I'm really happy about that.
Yeah, per capita basis would be an interesting way to look at that.
Are we going
to
put this data up on the website so people can go back and look at it later?
We might. Maybe we'll put it up someplace and put a link to that.
Okay.
Is maybe what we'll do. We'll have to think about that. Those are the questions that are sort of easy to quantify. There are a number of other questions that we asked that had very interesting results, one of which was, what is the one thing you'd change to make this podcast better? And questions like that and a few others indicated, at least to me, that everybody loves, well, let me put it this way, of all the segments and all the things we do, some people love every one of them, and some people hate every one of them, pretty much. So it's it's kind of a smorgasbord there of different kinds of things that people like, would like to see more of, same, or other people would like to see less of the same things. It's kind of all over the map. Did you guys get that impression as well?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's part of the thing, where you can't make everyone happy, and I think that's a good thing. One of the things that I found really interesting is the love that our listeners showed towards Grant and Steve with, you know, Plain Crazy or the Oz Desk. The fact that, you know, they don't have the time any longer to do that for us, but the love that our listeners expressed towards that was great. And that, you know, Peter isn't doing his segment any longer. I really think that it's great that people expressed interest in that, and you know, I understand why they're not doing it any longer, but it was great to hear that it was sorely missed.
Yeah, I think there's some gems buried in here that we've looked at and in some cases responded to, and in other cases I think there are things that we can tweak a little bit, adjust a little bit, but sort of the overall message I think is that, unlike some other podcasts, and I'm not thinking specifically of any, and I'm not talking strictly about aviation podcasts, but most of them tend to focus on a very narrow topic. It's very small niche. And for us here on Airplane Geeks, we don't really do that. I mean, aviation is not a niche, at least to me. It's huge, right? There's commercial, there's military, there's general aviation. There's all different kinds of different aspects to aviation. And we buck the advice that most podcast consultants would give you, which is to pick something narrow and focus in on that. We're broad. We're aviation, because we think here that aviation is fascinating in all of its flavors. And while some of us might be more attracted to certain aspects, certain elements of aviation than others, the rest of it is interestingly enough, or is interesting enough, and in many cases interrelates with what we are interested in, that it's worthwhile to have more of an expanded view of aviation. So the danger of that is some of the things that we see in the comments to the survey, is that not everybody likes all of it. But that's the way it's going to be, because we think all of it is very fascinating, and we want to look at all of it and hope you do too. But we really want to thank everybody who took part in the survey, contributed some really, really great feedback for us. As I mentioned, there's a lot of things that people suggested that we're going to continue to think about. And maybe you'll see some influences sort of seeping in different places. Maybe we'll do this again in 2 years and see how things change in that period. We certainly don't want to inundate people with surveys. We all get enough surveys as it is. So, again, thanks to those who participated in the survey. We really, really appreciate it.
And the criticism was absolutely appreciated, and we're going to ignore all of it.
No. So the first point, but okay, Brian, the first point there is always, and this is worthy of noting, is that actually a lot of people really did provide some criticism, generally constructive, not always, but generally constructive criticism. And that's great, because the last thing you want is a survey where all you hear about is, you know, the positive stuff, the good stuff, because, you know, you can't change, you can't improve yourself or what you produce, but based on just everybody telling you how much they like what you're doing. So we had both.
And I appreciate people being vocal over how they feel. Clearly, I am, over the things I'm passionate about, and I'll speak out about it. And I encourage our listeners to continue to speak up and say what they like, what they don't like, and let us know.
Yeah.
Because that's what makes the show, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Following up on what you were saying, you know, really, everybody should know how much we do appreciate the fact that so many hundreds of people care enough, not just to mention that they listened to us so many hours a week out of their lives, that they took the time to fill out those surveys. And despite all the things they said about me, I'm still coming back to 2017.
All right. All right. Next week, we'll have the two winners of our DVD Blu-ray giveaway of Living in the Age of Airplanes. Brian, you're going to randomly select a couple of winners for the, we have a DVD and a Blu-ray disc as well.
Yes, I've randomized all the entries. I've assigned numbers to them. We've put into the hat numbers, and we will select a number, and two winners will be announced next week.
Very good. Look forward to that. All right. Well, we want to thank you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Can I just throw in a random fact?
You have a random fact?
Yeah, just to drive Brian crazy. Okay. USC beat Penn State 52-49.
What?
Yeah.
Really? I wasn't watching the game. They won? Holy gee. Wow. Well done, USC. Go
they
Trojans.
They went nuts in the fourth quarter. Okay, I just thought I'd pass that on.
Charlie Bolden will be very happy. Fight on.
Find us at airplanegeeks.com. If you like to go right to the show notes for this episode, that's at airplanegeeks.com/433. You'll find on our website all the places on social media that you can find us, how to contact us, and all of that kind of information. Well, let's tell everybody where they can find us online. Rob Mark, we'll start with you.
Well, as I said, I'm going to be back in 2017. I'm so grateful that you guys renewed my contract, even with all the extra clauses for the cars and planes and things.
But checks in the mail.
Seriously, people will find us. Find us? Is there somebody here with me? Okay, I guess not. What I meant is they'll find me at flyingmag.com or inside the pages of Flying Magazine at jetwine.com or anything that has to do with Jetwine.
All right. And David Vanderhoof.
You can find me at whatjustflewby.com. You can find me on Twitter if you can spell Vanderhoof. And, of course, you can find me on Friday mornings with that guy, Max Flight, talking about drones and UAVs.
Good. And Max Trescott.
Well, I'm still upset that that Rob has more Twitter followers than I do. So, like I said before, you know, go unfollow Rob and come to my Twitter account. Look for Max Trescott on Twitter and follow me. And I'm just kidding, Rob.
Now, to be honest, Max, I can make you feel better. Jetwine has more followers than you.
Oh, and okay.
Jetwine is more than just Rob.
Okay.
You have more followers than Rob Mark's personal account.
I see. Okay.
I think better. On my personal, I have 11 or something. So.
All right.
And four of them are us.
I'll follow you to make you feel better.
I think he used to have more before you started talking about Donald Trump.
I didn't talk about Donald Trump tonight.
No, on your on your Twitter account.
Oh, I don't
know. Why do you think I got him to start his own personal account?
That was a smart move. All right, speaking of smart, here's Brian Coleman. Brian, how do folks get in touch with you?
Oh, the best place to get hold of me is at brian@airplanegeeks.com. And anyone that might have thought that I said something disparaging about Rob this evening, it's not true. Rob, you know I love you.
I knew that. Okay. Thank you. Because we do share that love of United Airlines. Let's be serious.
Okay.
We do.
You can find me on Twitter sometimes at Max Flight. You can look for me on LinkedIn. But especially, as David mentions, at the UAVDigest.com. Also at the PaxX Podcast with Mary Kirby. That's at PaxXPodcast.com. Also on the Airplane Geeks listener team, if you are interested in participating in that community, take a look at airplanegeeks.com/team, and you can learn more about that. Our intro music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. Outro is by Bruno Massone. He makes compositions with aviation sounds, and you can find those at brunomassone.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Fly safely.
Good night, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
And thanks for listening. We'll be right back.
We'll be right back.